Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host today is Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and the political events. It is Friday, February 21st, 2020. Good afternoon, Dave.
Happy Friday, Melody.
Happy Friday to you, and it certainly was a happy Friday in the gold prices today. It's very exciting. Oh boy. And for those of you who are just sitting there waiting for, I don't know what you're waiting for, but it is exciting. We have gold up another $24 today, $1,644 off the high of $1,650. So we did hit that, $1,644 for gold. Silver's up 13 cents today at 18.57. Palladium was the dog of the day, down $4 at $980, but it's still a good buy. I mean, people would be insane not to be going into any platinum today. I mean, it's crazy at these prices. And you know, I mean, if you're looking at palladium as a catalytic converter for automobiles, and did I see a number for China? I mean, their automobiles for the month of February dropped 90%. I mean, you would just think that eventually you're going to see, you know, the prices of palladium and rhodium begin to drop, but and platinum pick up. But at this point, palladium was up $21 at $27.61, and rhodium was up another 100 today. USDX today, we did find some weakness today, finally. And of course, part of that was we reflected in the large increase in gold today, but the dollar is still at 99.32. Crude oil was down 54 cents at 53.34. Stock market, you know, it was down 300 points earlier in the day. It came back some. We're still seeing some numbers tick through, but currently we're looking at the Dow still down under 1%, 227 points at 28,992. It did break down through that 29. It'll be interesting to see in the next 10 minutes if we don't see 8 points tick through just to keep it at 29, but we'll see. NASDAQ was down 174. Now, that's the one that got whacked. That was down a little over 1.75% at 9,576. The S&P was down 35 points, a little over 1% at 3,337. Now, the 10-year yield, it broke that the resistant point of 1.50. We're at 1.47. I think we're going to be talking about that here a little bit later on in this program. So all the yields are breaking down. And, of course, that just shows the mad dash into the 10-year yield. Security, safety, safe haven. The euro's still holding at 1.8, but it was a little stronger at 0.56 today. Hong Kong was down a little over 1%. European markets were, you know, not worth mentioning today. And the emotion, you know, I like to talk about the fear and greed index every once in a while. Well, that dropped down to 41. It was been hanging in there, still up there, you know, hanging around the 60 level, but a big drop to 41. And I believe we're beginning to see a little bit of the coronavirus impact coming into play. I think, you know, regardless of the effect on the number of people that fall ill and die from it, the economies that are being affected by it, I think it's going to be huge. And I don't know if this is, I don't think come April we're going to get reports coming out and saying, well, gee, it wasn't as bad as we thought it was going to be. I don't think that's going to happen unless, of course, governments do what governments do best, and they lie, and because they need to have their economies strong. So great day for gold today, and both gold and silver We'll see if we have any big ticks in the aftermarket. We'll make sure we bring it up. And Dave, even the big banks now are beginning to look to gold as 2,000. And I believe that, too. I told Butch the other day, I said, you know, it popped 1,600 and we're approached 1,650. It's not going to stop until it hits 2,000 is what I think. I think we're going to, well, we're going to have little pullbacks perhaps, but I think we're going to on the way to 2,000 and I certainly believe we're going to go higher than 2,000. But Citibank, Citigroup, came out and said today that they upgraded its 6 to 12-month price target for gold to 1,700 an ounce. And Citi commodity strategists also projected fresh nominal highs of 2,000 to be breached in the next 12 to 24 months. And Citi's statement said the setup in gold option markets and call skew is reminiscent of 2010 to 2011, of course, when we saw gold trading at the 18 to 2000 level. So there is a long net position on gold, and it's only half the levels of the 2011 peak. So, Dave, it's, you know, the paper markets are, you know, gold and silver, small markets, but once the paper traders get in there, they can move the prices, and then everything else falls into line. And
well, it's a good time to be paying close attention to the precious metal and paper markets if you're an investor or thinking about it. Now, Citi Group, while acknowledging that a slowdown in physical demand in Asia anyway provides a little downside risk going forward, you know, the analysts suggested that this would likely be offset by investor inflows and global central bank gold buying. As Melody mentioned earlier, gold hit a fresh 7-year high today, hitting the 1650 mark earlier in the morning. Gold, which started the year at 1519, is up over 8% in less than 2 months, more than half of which has come in just the past week. Silver's showing similar potential so far this year, although, you know, with more definitive ups and downs than gold. Nevertheless, it's risen about 4% since the start of the year, virtually all of it in the past week. Stocks in the U.S. and Europe continue to eke out fresh highs, but the composition of equity market gains will certainly render them fragile in the weeks and months ahead.
Well, you know, it's, we talked about this earlier in the week, possibly last week, where you're just looking at, you know, for the outside of the five big tech giants, you know, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, Alphabet. I mean, earnings growth on the S&P is flat. So, you know, more and more analysts are saying that the U.S. equities in particular are likely to see a correction in the near future. Well, we've been calling this, we're always early to the ball game, and that's a good thing because you get some very good seats when you're early. And you get to pay attention, and you're all prepared, ready to go. And so, you know, again, after the sell-off today, you know, we, of course, the new number of coronaviruses, that's escalating. And everybody is worried about the global economic slowdown. And it's coming, Dave. Tell us about the what was updated on the coronavirus.
Yeah, it's true. Well, China's health commission reported more than 75,000 confirmed cases and now over 2,000 deaths. That's just on the mainland alone. More than 800 new cases were reported just in China overnight. South Korea also reported more than 200 cases, which is raising some eyebrows. Peter Berzin of BCA Research warned even if the outbreak recedes, global growth is still set to fall to zero in the first quarter before bouncing back over the remainder of the year. Well, perhaps, perhaps not. The spread of the virus has already taken its toll on the Chinese economy. Data from the China Passenger Car Association showed auto sales plummeting, as Melody mentioned, by over 90%. the first 2 weeks of this month alone. And some U.S. companies, including Apple, warned this week about possible revenue headwinds going forward due to the virus. IHS Markit also said activity in the U.S. service sector hit its lowest level in more than 6 years, noting that confidence was subdued because of the coronavirus.
So,
what
else does it hit?
Well, manufacturing. The unprecedented gyrations caused by the coronavirus have hit the shipping business. That's because 90% of all trade moves by sea, and China's grown into the maritime industry's main source of cargoes. The disruptions have left toy makers like Hasbro and fashion houses like the owner of Michael Kors, Versace, and Jimmy Choo struggling with their supply chains. Vessels are sitting by idling, and exporters to China face diversions as clients there use force majeure clauses in their contracts to walk away from commitments to buy cargoes. Key gauges of manufacturing activity in Asia show that economies in the region are already taking a hit from the measures taken to contain the coronavirus. Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index for Japan, meanwhile, dropped to 47.6, while composite PMI for Australia fell to 48.3. Anything below 50 is considered a contraction in that sector of the economy, Melody.
Well, you know, there's still stories of Europe and, with what's happening, manufacturing in the region is contracted by less. We've reported on this, and it continues. We've seen the UK manufacturing showed a little bit of an expansion, but it's still shrinking. We've seen the U.S. dollar, it's been gaining strength except for today. So, there's a lot of things that are certainly peaking out at this point in time, and the coronavirus doesn't really help. It only adds to those stresses. And I think it's what's interesting, I think, about the coronavirus is, again, not to the degree that the numbers of it so far, but you have to think as it travels to other countries, particularly other Asian countries, will they or are they able to do what China has done in order to prevent the spreading? Not every country is going to be able to quarantine 60 million people at one time in a certain area to keep it contained. So if this is all the true numbers on everything and so forth that we're getting from China, what happens when this disease goes to Vietnam or when it goes to Philippines and to the Philippines or Africa? I mean, you don't hear anything about it, happening in Africa, or I don't know if cases have popped up there or not. So that's, the United States, we've already done pandemic training sessions to keep things contained. I mean, heck, you had a school, was it last year or the year before, that had an outbreak, had 10 kids with measles, and they quarantined them all and so forth. So, I mean, at least you will see that happen here, but in some of these other countries, and these countries are big deals in the economy chain anymore. The Vietnam and, all the Asian countries. I mean, we've seen what's happening in Japan. And we'll be talking to James Corbett on Wednesday of next week. We'll get an update to see if there's, from the news that's being reported versus, what he hears in Japan about the virus and how it's affecting everything in the economy. So, we're talking a little bit about trade with Africa and how that would impact, but it seems that the U.S., doesn't seem to make the assumption that Africa is one big country. I guess the less good news is that the trade relations with the continent's 55 states could become increasingly fragmented. Mike Pompeo, this was his first trip to Africa as Secretary of State this week. He focused on business ties as he met with officials in Senegal, Angola, and Ethiopia. He said, Pompeo said in Addis Ababa, Abba Abba Abba
Addis Ababa.
Addis Ababa,
Ababa.
that President Trump loves deals and wants more to happen between the U.S. and nations all across Africa. Now, this came across 2 weeks after Washington announced that it intended to start talks for a free trade deal with Kenya. The only other such pact is with Morocco. So, but Pompeo did take a swipe at South Africa, the continent's most industrial economy, and currently the U.S. biggest trading partner in the region.
Yeah,
What
he
did he
said,
say?
well, he said plans of South Africa's ruling party to allow land expropriation would be disastrous and described the policy proposal as an example of central planning that's failed in other African states, for example, Zimbabwe. Now, trade relations between the U.S. and African nations will come under increased scrutiny between now and 2025. That's when the African Growth and Opportunity Act, which provides sub-Saharan African countries duty-free access for about 6,500 products to America, expires. The Trump administration doesn't favor renewing it right now and wants the planned Kenyan deal to be a model for other arrangements with individual African countries. But there's an all-for-one, one-for-all pull in the opposite direction with the African Continental Free Trade Agreement that's been signed by all but one of the countries recognized by the African Union. The deal between the U.S. and Kenya could undermine this continent-wide commerce pact and certainly limit Africa's power to negotiate with the U.S. in the future.
Well, you know, one thing I'll have to say with the trade agreements that they're getting done and trying to get done is, you know, if we believe, if you believe, I believe, but if you believe that there's going to be a, you know, global economic recession, depression, to have these new trade agreements set up could be very beneficial to the United States during those times. So, but then again, I'm not so sure if there's a worldwide depression, recession, how trade with Africa and even India is going to benefit us, because certainly the wages in those countries will be significantly lower than what can happen here. And you know, perhaps you I could even see more jobs leaving this country in times of stress, economic stress. But I'm just saying. And I'm going to say that we're heading into a break right now. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSCTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Prices are incredible. Product is available. Give us a call, 800-375-4188. Visit the website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. And let's see. We have another week left in February, and let me take a peek at gold prices, see if we're still holding where we're at, or, yeah, we're still there at up 24, at 1645, basically, 1645 for gold, 1857 for silver. Pizza Hut, Dave. I don't know if we... Bankruptcy? Pizza Hut?
It's possible. Their largest franchisee in the U.S. is weighing restructuring options, including bankruptcy. NPC International, that's the name of the franchisee, operates nearly 400 Wendy restaurants and more than 1,200 Pizza Hut. Has about $1 billion in debt. Wow. Franchisee has reportedly begun negotiating with its lenders. The company's trying to keep the restructuring out of court, but it's considering the possibility of filing for bankruptcy with a pre-negotiated plan already in place. Now, last year, the franchise saw its debt slide further and further into junk territory after credit downgrades from S&P Global Ratings, as well as Moody's. Both rating agencies downgraded NPC's debt this week again after it didn't make interest payments that were due to its lenders on January 31st. Now, Pizza Hut, which is owned by Yum Brands, historically known as a dine-in restaurant, has struggled because more consumers want their food delivered. High food and labor costs have eaten into profits. Same-store sales fell 2% in the fourth quarter alone. Sounds like Yum Brands, which is the parent company of Pizza Hut, is looking over the shoulder of some of its larger franchisees. Domino's Pizza, Yum's biggest rivals, market value of $15 billion. Yum has a little over $31 billion. Well, so yeah, the retail apocalypse continues, Melody.
Doesn't Yum own like Olive Garden and
they own a bunch
Red
of
Lobster?
Chains.
You know, it's hard to, because those restaurants are successful. So, you know, I always go back to the quality of the food and everything. If it was good, people would go in. But, you know, sometimes you go into these pizza places anymore and they're just filthy. And, you know, it's just not appetizing. You know, they tried the buffet where you had the pizzas laying out on the counter and, you know, and you get flies flying around in there and stuff. It's like, yeah, no, I don't want to go in there.
Cheese curdling.
Yeah. So it's, and then they tried to do too much. They tried to do the salads. They tried to do this instead of sticking to what they knew best. That's pizza. And, you know, again, competition is good. It should keep you on your toes if you care to compete. But I think they just get sloppy, lazy, and, you know, poor management is really what, you know, takes them down and under, I think. Locations, I mean, there's a lot of things, but, I mean, Domino's Pizza.
I bet you.
Domino's Pizza isn't all that better.
Yuck. Yuck.
So you wouldn't think it would be difficult that if they think that people want it delivered, well, step up to the pump and get it delivered.
Well, you want some good pizza, go to your mom and pop shops.
That's true.
Stay away from most of, not all of these chains.
But that's true. But you know what? Your mom and pop shops are really getting expensive, though. I mean, you know, some of your mom and pop shops, what you get there, it's $20 versus, you know, $5.99. But, you know, the quality is
mm-hmm.
So, $20 for a pizza is expensive. But anyway, let's go ahead and talk about, I think this is interesting, Dave, where your levity is golden, where we have U.S. companies that are behaving like it's already a recession.
It looks that way. I mean, despite historically low interest rates, U.S. companies are being unusually frugal. We've been talking about this. They're holding back on issuing new debt. Maybe not so bad an idea, given where their debt already is, and they're pumping up their balance sheets recently with more cash. As we know, historically, when interest rates are low and the economy is generally strong, companies usually lever up to increase capital expenditures and buy assets in order to expand. Well, the opposite is happening now. In the short term, that means the country's perhaps a little less at risk for an actual economic collapse. But it does show that American businesses are investing less in the future. And to me, that says they know something that perhaps the rest of us don't, or know less, or just are hunching about. A number of analysts say that's highly unusual. As being late cycle as this economy is, this is precisely when companies are supposed to be levering up. They're not. Corporate debt, as we mentioned, is at an all-time high. Although official figures differ depending on the source, we're pretty confident. You know, it's in the range of many, many trillions of dollars. Net debt declined on a year-over-year basis in the fourth quarter of 2019 for the first time in nearly a decade, meaning companies are issuing less new debt and reducing current obligations at a pardon me excuse me at an uncommon rate. For example, about a quarter of companies reduced their debt levels last year by at least 8%. Those numbers are rarely seen during times that look like these on paper anyway. They're much more akin to what we see in a more forced basis during and in the aftermath of a recession. Now, despite increased profits from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, CEOs and company leaders point to the uncertainty of the U.S.-China trade war and fears of an imminent recession as factors that discouraged big-ticket spending last year. Perhaps what they're not telling you that it was the second year in a row that stock buybacks were coming in at just incredibly outrageous levels. But rather than use their tax savings for investment or expansion, you know, besides buying back their stock, they apparently socked it away. Cash holdings rose to $2.4 trillion, and that's the highest amount in decade. It's not just net debt either. Companies have added very little gross debt dating back to the second quarter of 2017. One analyst says it's really different this time. investment grade companies that would be in the best position to issue very cheap debt to finance investment projects or mergers are pulling back, in part because they spent so much between 2014 and 2017 pursuing large-scale M&A. The data show that many public companies are attempting to improve their fundamentals, but most of them are triple B rated. That's the lowest end of the investment grade scale. Everything is relative, ladies and gentlemen, and things aren't always what they appear to be or what the authorities say and want us to believe. And that melody, this week's levity, is golden.
All right. You know, and it's, you know, they are all doing that, and, you know, everybody should be doing that too, because the recession is coming, and it's recession depression. You know, I saw a headline. This is just a side thing, ladies and gentlemen. It's just a headline where I saw one Michael Bloomberg equals 660,000 American households wealth-wise.
I saw that.
660,000 American households, and I don't know what the, you know, what the criteria was to make that up, but you know, he made an estimated $3.5 billion last year, and of course he is by far the richest. He's pretty much the richest person the U.S. has ever. But I'd like to take a, you know, figure out the inflation on that, and but anyway, there was another headline that I thought we were talking about the coronavirus, and I had mentioned that you do have hospitals that are preparing for an outbreak for the United States, and let's see, there was another research thing real quick here. I think it's kind of interesting that we're going to talk about the triple B rated corporate bonds, where buyers need to borrow 18 times more compared to the 1970s. In contrast, salaries have only increased 11-fold since the 70s. This mm-hmm. was new research that was done by a digital broker, Moho, I don't know if you want to call it Mojo. Sometimes the J is silent. We'll call it Mojo Mortgages. And that's what they revealed. First-time buyers need to borrow 18 times more than an average first-time buyer in the 70s. I mean, that's really amazing. That goes to show you your strength of your dollar.
Yeah.
Or I should say the you know, how many more of those dollars that it takes, your purchasing power. Exactly. And that really is an interesting comparison, and maybe we'll try to get that into the newsletters. There's a couple of things I wanted to get into the newsletter this week, along with yours, Dave. So, you know, we have triple B rated corporate bonds. It hits a record, 50%. The number of companies around the world that had their credit ratings downgraded from investment grade to speculative grade. You know, they call them fallen angels. Hit the lowest level in 23 years. There were 19 fallen angels last year, which marked the fourth consecutive year. And credit downgrades fell to a record low, 0.3%. The number of so-called zombie companies or businesses with interest payments higher than your annual earnings have reached a level not seen since the global crisis. Did you hear that, ladies and gentlemen? The number of so-called zombie companies or businesses with interest payments higher than their annual earnings have reached a level not seen since the global financial crisis. The percentage of public companies in the U.S. losing money over 12 months have risen close to 40%. This is the highest level since the late 1990s. Outside of post-recession periods. So,
triple B rated bonds have grown to a record 50%, one half of all outstanding investment grade corporate debt. That means essentially 50% of corporate bonds right now are on the verge of being junk. Many companies appear to be holding their investment grade ratings by adding significantly to their debt load. It seems ironic. Last week, the New York Fed also warned that downgrades to the flood of bonds sitting at the lower end of the investment grade spectrum pose a financial stability concern. Yeah, you think? And in October, the International Monetary Fund said that $19 trillion of corporate debt globally could be at risk in a recession that's just half as severe as that of the global financial crisis. On the other side, well, the global tally of companies with credit ratings upgraded to investment grade from speculative was the lowest in 10 years. Things are rotten in Denmark, ladies and gentlemen, in Germany, India, and the United States, too, especially when it comes to corporate debt.
And, you know, it's the same thing. They just repeat, 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 crash, repeat, 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 crash. But each time they repeat and crash after their crash, it's not like they go back to where they were and start and keep it capped. They just, it multiplies, and each time it just gets worse and worse and worse. And I believe we're at that point where one, it's not going to come back. And that's what they've conditioned everyone to believe, that when these market corrects, it always come back. You don't want to sell your stock. They don't want you selling your stock. They don't want the panics. And I get it. I mean, I do get it, but people, you need to, you know, take care of yourself. And these numbers are really, to me, they're staggering, Dave, compared with everything else that's going on and how our economies have gotten to where we are today with all kinds of stimulus and really very little on their very own strength for the basic fundamentals for a strong economy. I mean,
I don't know if I could agree with you anymore on that one.
And what happens, we're going to get, and the market won't come back, ladies and gentlemen, but they have conditioned everyone to believe that it will. So don't sell your stocks. That's what they tell you. And you should always do the opposite of what they tell you. Mexican central banks, they cut their interest rates. I think we talked about this, 7% last week. That was marking the 800th. I don't know why I think that's funny.
Oh, well, it's ironic. I mean, the central banks don't manipulate economies.
Oh, the heavens. 800th interest rate cut by the central bank since Lehman went belly up in September of 2008. The number of rate cuts from central banks have picked up steam since last year. And again, the global economy's growth rate, it's stumbling to its slowest since the financial crisis. All of these things are pointing back to the financial crisis, so I don't understand how everybody can feel so optimistic of our economy. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm optimistic that we'll be back in just a few minutes. Thank you for joining us.
I need to hear it just one more time. Oh, won't you tell me again?
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with Dave Allen. You know, I mentioned a little bit ago that hospitals across the U.S. are preparing for the coronavirus outbreak to become a global pandemic. And in the meantime, what's going to happen when you have the rural and urban hospitals that are closing, Dave? I mean, that's not going to be very helpful.
Certainly not. I mean, in rural towns across the U.S., hospitals are in crisis mode. Since 2010, over 120 rural hospitals have closed. In fact, the National Rural Health Association says that more than one-third of all rural hospitals are now, the ones that remain, are at serious risk of shutting down. The decision by some states not to expand Medicaid as part of the Affordable Care Act could be one of the reasons for some of the closures. That's according to the Georgetown University Health Policy Institute. Hospital consolidation, demographics, and a drop in demand for inpatient services are other factors. But it's not just rural hospitals that are going out of business, Melody. Several hospitals in urban areas have shut down too. One happens to be near and dear to my family's heart. Recent high-profile closure was Philadelphia's Hahnemann University Hospital, nearly 500-bed hospital, considered by many to be a lifeline for the city's neediest. It shut its doors in September as it struggled with monthly losses of $3 to $5 million. Happens also to be the hospital where our daughter was born.
Yeah. That's a lot of losses per month.
I know.
And
I know, but for as big it is, I mean, I think it would be even more, but a million here, a million there, right?
Well, what I don't understand is, I get the demographics that could change, but a drop in demand for inpatient services?
Yeah,
I thought that was on the rise. Because they don't want you in the hospital, so it's all of it is inpatient. Well, I'm thinking of outpatient.
Outpatient. Maybe that's why.
Yeah.
Because they just want to do outpatient. Heck, you can have a cesarean section now for a birth and, you know, be kicked out, you know, a day or two later.
So why don't they keep people longer?
Yeah.
So they created their own beast. They were trying to turn over so many, they'd kick you out. But now they kick you out not because you're healthier or they don't want to keep you. They want to kick you out so you don't get an infection. That's how bad these hospitals are, which just baffles me.
Yeah.
You know, that they're in such bad condition to, you know, you have to worry about infections, you know, being in the hospital. And I can remember, Dave, I can still remember the smell from being a little girl and you'd go to the hospital to visit somebody, most likely your grandparents. And you could smell the bleach. You could smell the products that they used to clean, and it smelled clean. Now you go into hospitals, and they just stink.
How different! One of my first jobs in high school was a buddy of mine, and I both got jobs hired at the same time. At the local hospital, we cleaned floors. We cleaned, we buffed floors and otherwise cleaned and waxed them. And I'll tell you this, and this is back in what, the 70s. And you talk about the smell. We had to wear masks because it was nearly overwhelming sometimes.
Yeah. But it doesn't seem to have the same today. You know, and then maybe that's just me, but yeah, you know, these, you know, the larger U.S. hospital systems, they seem to be thriving though, Dave. Since the 90s, you've had the mergers and acquisitions, and they've created these mammoth hospital groups, you know, which also a lot of these hospital groups then provide the health care. Some of these consortiums, they're turning huge profits every year. And by offering high-priced service like cardiac and orthopedic care to, of course, the well-insured patients. And every hospital has its own model for how it brings in cash. Hospitals charge the highest rates to private commercial payers, people covered by private employer insurance. They receive lower payment rates for patients covered under government programs such as Medicare for the disabled and people over 65 and Medicaid. Of course, that covers the low-income Americans. A hospital's location, of course, too, as I mentioned earlier, can be a big indicator of the type of insurance a patient will have.
Indeed, the literature, that same literature, says that larger metropolitan areas tend to have more people who are covered under private employer health insurance, thus boosting the percentage of higher-paying patients. Rural areas, excuse me, on the other hand, with fewer large employers, make for a lower number of privately insured patients. Dr. Marty McCary, he's a surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital, said hospitals in wealthy communities have well-insured patients. Hospitals that are predominantly taking care of government-insured patients or poorer patients tend to struggle. One way hospitals have been able to drum up more cash is by, hey, guess what? Raising prices, particularly on private insurance plans. And one way hospital systems strengthen their ability to do that is by getting bigger. Analysts say that's one of the factors driving all the mergers and consolidations across U.S. hospitals today. By gaining market share, they can raise their prices. In other words, look out for continuing mergers in the years to come, ladies and gentlemen.
Just like anything else, Dave, when hospitals became profit, you know, hospitals for profit, that's when it all changed. And it's, you know, it's just absolutely, and even some of your, I know, the hospital where I'm located at, the close one, everybody wants to go up to Johns Hopkins up in Baltimore because, you know, it's one of these little hospitals that once you go in, a lot of people don't come back out. And it's usually for, that's the reputation. It's a reputation they have. And, you know, people go in for something as, you know, a hangnail and don't come out. And it's, and everybody's afraid to go there. And you only go there if you absolutely have to and you don't have a choice. Everybody wants to go to the larger hospital up in Salisbury or, you know, if you have time and, you know, it's on a regular, you know, some sort of a patient surgery, not an emergency, you'll go to Johns Hopkins. And so it's, you can't get good health care. You can't get good care, not health care, good care in these smaller hospitals. You don't have doctors that are, they, these hospitals in the lower rural areas don't have the, I mean, doctors don't want to move to the rural areas anymore. And there's nothing for them. You know, they don't want to raise their families. The schools usually aren't as good as, you know, when you go to the you know, the city and so forth, where you can get better schools and, you know, have at least better choices. I'm not saying they're better, but at least they have better choices. So to get a good doctor into these little areas, it's difficult. So when you don't have good doctors, well, that's another one of their problems. So we talk about this once in a while. We're going to change the topic here. And we had the dollar almost breach 100. We're getting close. Had a big drop today. And everybody, you hear Larry Kudlow talk about, oh, got to have that strong dollar, got to have that strong dollar. Everybody wants a strong dollar. Ultimately, we know government wants a weaker dollar. We know they need a weaker dollar. Government needs inflation. But strong dollars, when they talk about this, when it gets to a certain point, they do have unwelcome effects. Now, we've seen the dollar, it's been, you know, is the strongest it has been in nearly 3 years. The dollar climbed to its highest level in years this week. And again, it's a reflection of the standout status of the American economy that's based, you know, against a global backdrop that's clouded by the coronavirus. You continue to have pessimistic economic updates from Japan, Britain, Germany. That has only added to the uncertainty that's created by the coronavirus. And basically, that has all but idled China's economy for weeks. A 92% drop in automobiles in the first 2 weeks. We talked about a 90% drop in housing in China for the first part of the month. I mean, if those are real numbers, to have that kind of a drop, I mean, the whole place has got to be like a ghost town. And so we've seen the slowdown stimulated a rush into American stocks and bonds, and you know, we've seen the value of the dollar pushed higher, and then use those dollars to snap up financial assets. And so they're, you know, people are spooked about the virus. They're spooked about the global economy that's weakening. So tell us about the index, Dave. We haven't talked about this for a while.
Well, U.S. dollar index, which, excuse me, as many listeners know, measures the dollar value against six other currencies, mainly of its major trading partners. It's up more than 3.5% this year, pushing it to its highest level since April of 2017. It was up 0.2% yesterday and up even a little bit more today, I think 0.3%. The dollar's risen more than 1% against China's government-managed yuan in February alone. For the year, it's up more than 3.5% against the euro, 3% against the yen, and more than 2.5% against the British pound. Those regions have faced a flurry of lackluster economic results. Official reports this month showed that the British economy virtually tanked. They had flatlined during the fourth quarter. Probably not going to be any better in the next quarter or two as well, post-Brexit. A report last week showed that the Japanese economy shriveled at a 6.3% annual clip in the fourth quarter. And that was in part because of a tax increase there.
We're just about, we have about 3 minutes left of the program, and I want to go on to this. It's, I mean, sometimes the American consumer out there really doesn't have a have a chance. They really don't. And that's what's so frustrated. It's so, you know, the American consumer out there gets held responsible, is held accountable, and they should be for their decisions, but yet they're so heavily influenced daily through advertisements. Everything is made so easy for them. And now you have, is it Yodlee? It's the largest financial data broker in the U.S. And what they do is they sell, they sell data pulled from the bank and credit card transactions of tens of millions of Americans to investment and research firms, detailing where and when people shopped and how much they spent. The company claims that the data is anonymous, but a confidential Yodlee document indicates that the individual users could be unmasked. The findings come as multiple senators have urged the FTC to investigate EvansNet, which owns Yodlee, for selling Americans transaction information without our knowledge or consent. Potentially?
Outrageous.
Potentially violating the law? The Yodlee document describes in detail what type of data its clients gain access to, how the company manages that data across its infrastructure, and the specific measures Yodlee takes to try and anonymize its data set. And it comes from everywhere, Dave, and it's just amazing.
Banks, credit card companies, apps, Bank of America, Citigroup, HSBC. According to this confidential document, the data include a unique identifier given to the bank or credit card holder who made the purchase. The amount spent for the transaction, the date of the sale, the city, state, and zip of the business the person bought from, and other pieces of data. One example that's given is that, say, someone bought a meal from Applebee's using the delivery service Grubhub. Applebee's would be marked in the data as the primary merchant and Grubhub as a secondary merchant. Once logged into Yodlee's server, clients download the data as a large text file rather than interacting with the data in, you know, an interface that stays solely within Yodlee's control. It's out of hand, and it's only getting worse, ladies and gentlemen.
It really is. There's nothing private in this world. The only private that you can have is gold and silver. 1-800-375-4188. Give us a call today. We'll be here until Monday. We'll be back Monday. Until then, be safe, good night, and God bless.
Bye-bye. That's too bad.